This is Leslie Jenkins recording an interview with Joe Larkin on the 23rd of October 2012 in his home at Cabarita. Joe, can I start by asking you your full name, including your middle name, and your date and place of birth?
My proper name is John Michael Larkin, and I was born on the 28th of June 1933.
And where were you born, Joe?
I was born in Harbord, or Freshwater as they call it now, in the Northern Beaches, New South Wales.
Was it called Harbord when you were born, or Freshwater?
Harbord, Harbord. The history of the name was that it was originally called Freshwater, and it got such a bad reputation because of people going over there for parties from Manly, that when they went to sell it and put on the market as real estate, They couldn't sell it under the name of Freshwater, so they changed the name to Harbord.
Oh, that's interesting. I didn't know that.
Yeah. It was a party place.
Oh. And did you spend all of your formative years there?
Yes, I didn't leave there until I was nearly 30.
And what occupation did your father have?
My father had a shop, a little, you know, little mum and dad shop, but in those days they... Harbord was weekenders. People used to come from Balmain and Leichhardt and all that, and they had little sheds and shacks up on the side of the hills. And Dad had all the keys, and they used to call in on the Friday night, any time up until midnight, get their keys and go. And he was the bread, milk, the usual thing. And then after the Second World War, it became more or less a suburb.
Do you have any brothers or sisters?
I've got two sisters, still alive. Yep, they're older than me. I'm the baby, so I got spoiled.
Did they go surfing with you?
No, they both surfed, but not board riding or anything. They just went body surfing.
And was your dad a surfer?
He wasn't a board rider, body surfer only.
And tell me about your first experiences with surfing on a board.
It came about when I was nine. It was 1942, and there were a lot of local boys and that. They were only 18 and that. They were going to war, and there was a young bloke. Unfortunately, would you believe it, I've forgotten his name, but he knew that Dad, I lived close to the beach, and he said, you may as well have this board and play around with it, you and your mate. While I'm away, he said, look after it. Anyhow, he never came back. Yeah,
was that person Bo Sullivan?
No, Bo Sullivan was he was injured in an accident or the First World War, and he had a metal plate in his head, and he was a little bit funny, but he was a great surfer, great body surfer. And Bo Sullivan, that's why I love body surfing. When I was a little kid, I'd go out the back with him, and he taught me a lot of skills, you know. He didn't say much, but he used to just say, watch me.
Did you ever have any fear about going out the back where you'd get the bigger waves to ride in?
When I was younger, it was all, you know, everything's five times bigger. And he'd be going out in what he probably thought was a small day, but I thought it was pretty big. But I used to just, I thought, well, he's there, I'll be all right, you know.
You must have been a pretty good swimmer, were you, to go out that far at such a young age?
I never got formally taught to swim, but my uncle taught me in the old rock pool at Harbord. And, I never had any technique, but I was fairly strong. I was fairly strongly built, so I was lucky that way.
Mm. Did you see any sharks or other marine life out there?
Not a great deal, no, not on the body. No, not down there, but I have when I moved up here. I saw plenty.
Up to Queensland.
Then, yeah, but not in Sydney, no. We had sightings from the beach and all that, but actually while I was out there, I never had an encounter, thank God.
Were you involved in the local surf club?
Yes.
And yeah. From what age?
As soon as I was 17 or something. They didn't have nippers or anything like that in those days. They didn't even have cadets, they had juniors, so you had to be, I think, at least 16 before you could join the surf club. So I actually, my dad wouldn't let me join Freshie. I joined South Kirkhill first because they had a no drinking policy at their surf club. So I was in South Curly for a year. And also my cousin was the club captain and what have you. But I soon, yeah, Freshwater was 100 yards away, whereas I had to get on the bike and go around to South Curly, you know.
What sort of activities did you do in the surf club?
Well, I did everything. We went in the open surf and board paddled, raced the surfboards, and I rode in the boat crew for in South Kirkhill. I was in the boat crew. We got third in the Australian titles when we were juniors over in Western Australia in 1951. It was a lot of fun, that trip.
Mm.
We towed the boat over and across the Nullarbor, 2,000 miles of dirt road. Yeah, pretty...
Did your father go with you on
that? No. We had a truck. There's 20 blokes in the back of the truck, and we had the boat, towing the boat on the back, and the trailer broke about five or six times. We had it wired up with wire and anything we could to keep it going until we hit another town, then we'd get it welded up again. It took about 10 days to get over... No, wait a sec, I might be... No. Probably took about a week to get to Perth. We overnighted it and, you know, drove and drove and drove in the dust. We all had the old motorbike goggles on because the dust was coming up into the back of the truck. It was thick. You know, we'd get out of, and we'd all look like, you know, like we'd come from the middle of the desert or something.
It was, you've had, yeah, in a way,
yeah,
haven't you?
Yeah, yeah.
And tell me when you stopped being interested in being a member of the surf club.
I've always been associated with the surf club, and I've got a high regard for the surf clubs, and I'm afraid that where you pick up all your knowledge of surfing, I did, and all my contemporaries, was through the surf clubs. You know, the older members, their knowledge came back down to you, how to catch a wave, what to look for. Where are the kids going to learn all that?
Did they teach you how to read the beach conditions too?
Well, yeah, absolutely. You know, you were on patrol, so you had a head patrolman, and he'd say, well, we'll put the flags, and you say, what for? Well, look at this, look at that. You can actually, it's like a map once you know what you're doing. And, it stuns me that people go down the beach and jump right into the wrong place nearly every time. If the water's calm looking, it means it's deep and there's a tail. If there's a wave break, it means there's it's shallow. And they jump into these deep bits with a rip and they're straight out there, you know.
Well, especially newcomers to the country.
Oh, yeah.
Asians, people who are not used to
They haven't got a clue, and you don't blame them, but it's sad. Yeah, A lot of them get lost, yeah.
So tell me a bit about your introduction to board riding. How did that happen?
Well, as I said, we had this old hollow, not hollow, it was a solid wooden board, and me and my mate, took us about half a day to get dragged down the beach, and half a day to get it back. And we couldn't figure out how to ride it, but when I started my trade as a 14-year-old, I had another apprentice who was 3 years older than me, and he used to ride one of these 16-footers, and he made his own. So when I had enough money to buy the timber, I started making mine. I was 15 at the time.
What tools did you use back then to make your board?
Well, there was no electrical tools at all, except in the big joinery shops. I just had a handsaw, a hand plane, and a screwdriver, and that's about it.
And that was made out of marine ply, was it?
Yes, yeah.
And they called them a toothpick, did they?
Well,
then?
No, we called them surfboards. It's a modern terminology, a toothpick.
And was it expensive to buy the marine ply?
Yeah, it was a week. It was more than it was about 3 weeks' wages for if you had to buy a surfboard. They were a pound a foot, And when I was 15, I think I wasn't even getting a pound. I think I was getting about 15 shillings a week. So, but to build your own, it was cheaper. But it was still fairly expensive. I had to save up and see the boss and see whether he'd sell me the timber at the right price for the rails and all that. And, yeah, no, that's why even at 15, it was a struggle to get the materials because it was fairly expensive.
Mm. It seemed like a lot happened for you around 1956. The Americans came out and you saw them at Manly. You were working as a beach inspector.
Yeah.
And then also around that time, you worked with Billy...
Clymer.
Clymer. So can you tell me a bit about those two things?
Yeah, well, what happened... 1954, actually, I was working in Wollumbar on the and in Coolangatta. I got a job working on the Regal Theatre when they were building it. And after that, we went down to Wollumbar and did the post office. Anyhow, I had a bit of a fracas with the delegate from the union, and I got fired. So I tail between my legs, I went back to Sydney. And while I was there, the boy said, oh, well, there's a job going in New Guinea. Anyhow, that wasn't in 54, that was 56. I thought, well, I'll give that a try. So up I went to New Guinea and I worked in New Guinea in Bulala, in the timber mill and building houses and that, and reconstruction.
Is that on the coast?
No, it's up in the right up in the highlands.
And you were working as a carpenter?
Yeah, and we were prefabricating houses, putting them on the old DC-3s, and they were flying down to Port Moresby, and they were erected down there. Anyhow, they offered me a job of doing the same thing at Lay. So we drove back to Lay and waited for these prefab houses to come. And, of course, it started raining. Lay's notorious, and it rained and rained and rained, and... we were in the hotel for about a month straight, and I thought, well, I'm going crazy here. So I packed up and left. I left New Guinea after 6 months. And I got back to Sydney, and I was offered a job as a beach inspector. One of the blokes I knew was leaving, and he said, yeah, this will be all right for a... And I got a job with Manly Council.
What did they pay back then?
I think we were getting around about £15, something like that.
And a week, and that was just for the summer months, was it?
No, because I was a carpenter, I got a 12-month contract because on the off-season, I'd do the deck chairs at Manly. They'd repair all the deck chairs and any woodwork. North Stain, we re-floored the dressing sheds and all that sort of thing. And then if it was a nice day and people came to the beach, they told us that we used to put the flags out and go and do the beach inspecting again. Anyhow, that was a good job. Yeah, it was great. But while that was on, that was 1956. They had the Olympic Games, as you know, and the American they had an Olympic surf life saving contest, and they had the Americans over, and I think some South Africans and what have you. And I saw the Yanks with their balsa boards and a fin, and they were doing all these tricks on the waves, and I couldn't believe it. And I told you the story. I climbed the Manly Shark Tower with my little 8mm camera. I was up there, and I was so excited. I'm taking all these photos and movie and what have you, and I got back down to the ground again after all this and showing everyone. I said, oh, wait till we see this. I realised I hadn't taken the cap off the camera. And in those days, they weren't reflex cameras. They were through a view, separate viewfinder. So you didn't know that you had the cap on. So I lost all that film.
Oh, dear, that must have been tragic.
Yeah, yeah, well, yeah, and once we saw these little boards, I thought, well, that's great. I'll go home and make a plywood one. And, yeah, there was Billy Wallace, Barry Bennett, Gordon Woods. There was a lot of people, especially in the board building business. They thought the same, you know, and we all built virtually. they nearly all looked the same. We in plywood, and we nicknamed them Okanuis. So that was the start of the actual, that was the real start of a surfing industry in Australia.
So where did the name come from, Okanui?
Oh, it's an Hawaiian name. Don't ask me what it means. I think it means, you know, could mean anything. Someone will know what it means, but I don't.
Where did your interest in photography come from, and where did you get your first camera?
I had an auntie that was really into movies, early movie making, and she was an editor in films in the early days, in the late 20s and 26. I think she was with, he made a lot of films in the South Pacific and that. Anyhow, she was always fluttering away around the world and coming back with these movies, and then we'd gather the movies and see her name up as editor of these films. And I just, as soon as I had enough money, I bought a movie camera. You know, not many movie cameras around those days. I bought it in Moorloombah, my very first movie camera, in 1954. It was a little 8mm. It was a Bolex Palette. And when I came back in 56 and saw the surfing movie started to come out to us, and I thought, we've got to get a bigger one. So I went down, just in Manly, and bought it off the local cameraman down there and paid it off forever.
So you were getting movies coming out from America to watch?
Yeah.
And that influenced your decision to make movies?
Oh, yeah. It was fun, you know, it was a lot of fun.
So where did you do the post-production, you know, the editing?
Well, that was a classic. We had a little very manual editing machine, and Bobby Evans was as keen as I was, and he was more or less the editor. But we had a wind-up gramophone, and I had the disc of the the ride of the Valkyries.
Oh, the Valkyries.
Wagner. And we've taken this movie, and we're playing it in, I think it was Queenscliff Surf Club, too, Bob, to get in. And the waves are about 3 foot high, and we've got this dramatic music in the background. But everyone loved it. So, and after I moved up to Queensland, I sold everything to Bob. So all the top movies and everything were virtually Bob by himself. But I did do all the filming of the Bombora. I was on the camera for all the stuff of the Bombora before I left Sydney.
And was that a Bob Evans film?
Well, it was sold to the ABC, I think, and it's been seen around a lot. And I think the ABC made a show not only a few years back called Bombora with that movie. And I never got the credit of it, but it was me, the cameraman. Because I talked to Dave Jackman. I said, Dave, you're the best surfer in Australia. I said, you've got to be out there, so we wound him up a bit so he'd go out in this huge surf and crack the Bombora, you know.
How did you meet Bob Evans?
Surfing. He was a member of Queenscliff Surf Club, and he rode the 16-footers, and when there was a bit of a surf on, we'd all probably go to Fairy Bower if you're in that area, over the Bower, and I just through surfing. And his brother Dick, he was in Freshwater Surf Club. Bobby was in Queenscliff, but his brother was in Freshy. And Dick was a great body surfer too. But Bob was absolutely magnificent. And he was one of the first guys ever to have bowel cancer. Or not, one of the first to survive it. And he had the bag, and he used to wear these high, tight-fitting costumes. And he surfed all his life with that. And he got that cancer when he was very young. He was about 26 or something when he got the cancer.
Many people know that, do they?
No. And Bob had that all his life, you know. And it was the old type bag. It was a lot of trouble, you know. But it never worried him, never worried Bob. So, I've got a lot of time for Bobby Evans.
Did you make any money out of the film?
Never made money out of anything. I made a lot of fun. That's what we got.
Fun units were high.
Yeah, yeah. The fun and just doing something different and all that. There's no price on it.
When did you start going on safaris, which became, you know, a more common feature of the surfing movement?
We thought a safari was going to Avalon and that, but eventually we spread our wings and we'd go to Avoca and Copacabana up there, and then we went down south one time, Batesman's Bay or that
Naruma.
Way. Naruma. That was the southern trips, and then we went north and we got to Seal Rocks and then Crescent Heads and then, all the way up here, because I'd been coming up to Coolangatta even before the 56.
What introduced you to Coolangatta?
When I was 15, my first holidays as a carpenter, I started as a worker when I was 14.
And were you an apprentice to
someone? Yeah, apprentice carpenter, and we used to get 3 weeks at Christmas. And a mate said, let's go to Coolangatta. So we got on the train and at Sydney and got the Rattler up to Moranbah. It took 24 hours. And then the bus from Moranbah to Coolangatta, and it was great. And that's when I decided to live in Coolangatta or somewhere near here as soon as I could. It took another 15 years.
What did you like about Coolangatta in those days? Obviously, it's very different to how it is now. There were a lot of guest houses.
It was a party town. A lot of girls, and there were nice hotels. Good. Everything was cheap. Cheap as chips.
Cheaper than Sydney.
Oh yeah, much cheaper. I had full. We had full board and food and everything. Full board for I think it was about 30 shillings a week.
Were the waves
The waves
crowded
were good.
Or uncrowded?
No, uncrowded. No, that was another thing. They'd be lucky to be 3 or 4 people out.
You said earlier that when you surfed up there, you did see a lot of marine life.
Oh, yeah. Well, the bait fish had come by and then, literally hundreds of sharks. And at one stage, I remember, must have been about 63, going by memory, the sharks were coming in to snap a rocks up in between the rocks. And who was it? Johnny Dean. Johnny Dean, he had an old army rifle. He was shooting the sharks from the rocks. And that's the Dean's dad, the boys, the two surfers. And it was unbelievable, you'd be out there and swimming and they'd go by. You'd see them, the sharks. They weren't interested in you, thank God, but there were plenty of them. You can get on top of Greenmount Hill and it was like fleets of planes going by. I'd be heading up the coast chasing the bait.
So did that worry you a bit more?
Oh, well, I never stuck around. If I knew there were sharks out there, I got out. A lot of the guys didn't, but I did. I thought, well, I'm not going to
hang about.
No.
And did you get involved in the surf club up there?
I was a little bit, but mainly I'd done my years as like patrolling and lifeguard 7 days a week, 4 years in a row. And when I got up here, I started a family, and I was still in touch with the surf club, and I'd still paid my membership. I was a non-active member.
And when you moved up to Queensland, did you get involved in making boards?
Oh, yeah, that's the reason I came to Queensland. I started virtually, I wouldn't say I was the very first, but I'm obviously one of the very first to actually manufacture with my own factory and that on the Gold Coast.
And tell me a little bit about how you were able to get that business going. I believe you rented premises first.
Yeah, the year before I was up here on holidays, and I thought, I'm going to do it. And I looked around, and there was a bloke called Johnny Robinson had a couple of sheds down the bottom of Mile Street. Mile Street is the one that comes from the hotel back towards the border. And I thought, that's nice and handy, close to the hotel and close to the beach. So I picked him up on that and paid him a little deposit. And when I came back up in February the next year, I moved into there. I only had half of it when I started. So Billy Stafford kindly, around in the main street of Coolangatta, he had a shed out the back of his back of the shop, and he let me use that for glassing. So I used to shape the boards around Mile Street and then put them in the car and take them around there and glass them in the back of Billy Stafford's. She was a funny old setup. But
and Billy Stafford's, did he have a son at those days that was in those days? Old enough to be surfing?
Yeah, young Billy was about, when it started, he would have been about 14 or something like that. And he was a very good surfer. He was the first Queensland junior surf champion when he in 64.
And tell me about the difference between using fiberglass back then and creating a board with fiberglass now.
Well, number one, the resin was very thick, much thicker than it is today. We had to do the promoter as well as the hardener. And today it's already promoted. And right at the very beginning, before I even got up to Queensland, though, at the very beginning, they were all laminating resin so that the resin never went right hard because they were meant to be used for moulding things, not for air finish. But, it was a lot. And the glass was much... we used to use 10-ounce, heavier and coarser, and took a lot more saturation to get the resin into it and to mould it, whereas today the glass is a lot finer and easier to handle, and the resin's like water, so it's really, really easy compared with the old days. But it was progressive. It slowly but surely got better and better as the years went by, you know.
And in the 60s, were you sanding the fiberglass with machinery?
Oh, yeah. They were very heavy. They were heavy industrial grinders, nearly, and we put pads and sanders on them. But later on, they became lighter machines, but we had sanders, yeah.
And did you wear masks in those
days?
No,
I didn't. And there was a lot of us. Some of us did, some of us didn't. But, it was something, probably we should have all been wearing them, but I had great difficulty wearing them. I used to sort of like half suffocate. I got claustrophobic with the damn things on.
And I suppose they're better now than they were then.
Yeah. Yeah. They had the proper ones.
Did you ever get any illness later
on? No, I didn't.
From fiberglass?
But I'm sure some of the guys must have got something out of it. Because it isn't really good.
Yeah.
Excuse me for a minute.
Yes, okay. We were talking about the factory. Johnny Robinson rented you this factory.
Yeah.
That's right. And where was that?
It was Mile Street and Coolangatta Road, right about one house back from the corner.
Was it very big?
Oh, no, it wasn't, but it was enough because we had a spare block next door. And in those days, we used to just sand out in the open, went everywhere. But eventually, we got a caravan. We found an old plywood caravan, and we turned that into our sanding bay on the block. So everything, it worked along, nothing like they've got today, but we potted along. We used to do a lot of surfboards.
Can you tell me the story about your girlfriend of the time, who later became your wife, helped you to establish the business?
Oh, this is a bit of a joke, actually. We had an on-and-off relationship ever since we were very young. We had an on-and-off relationship, from the very young age, and always having arguments and blues, and I'd go my way and she'd go her way. Anyhow, I was down the pub one night, and I didn't know anything about it, but I was pretty cheerful, and someone said, "Oh, your ex-girlfriend won the lottery." And I said, "Oh, what's this?" Because I thought she'd pour a beer over my head, and I run into this Canopus room, and I got down on my knee and I said, "Will you marry me?" And she said, "Yes." Well, I nearly fell out. It was a bit of a joke, and I thought, well, that's not, yeah, must be fair deal, you know. So, we went ahead.
You had been going together for 14 or so years.
About 11 years, yeah, yeah, 11 on and off. But always ended up in the blue or something. But, yeah, so that was good. And that was meant to last. Everyone came to the, you know, all the fiberglass mob and the factory bloke. Yeah, Joel last 6 months, that were the ones that lasted the longest, you know.
And was she, your wife, a surfer?
No, but she always went to, I used to take her out in tandem. I built a tandem surfboard, and but she never really, she just used to like the beach.
And was the tandem board bigger than a normal board?
Yeah, yeah, it's, you know, these paddle boards that they're riding around now, they're something like the bigger version of them before they brought them back down to size. But, yeah, that, and it's a beautiful thing to watch. I love watching the tandem surfers in Hawaii and Californians and that. There's some really, yeah, they get the girls and they're doing all sorts of tricks, and it's really, really something to look at. And I rather love watching it, especially Noosa. They go up to Noosa sometimes at the Noosa Festival, and a couple of the guys are very good up there. A Sydney guy, I've forgotten his name now. Anyhow, him and his girlfriend, they get up there, and it's really great to see what they can do.
Was your wife nervous if you were going down a big wave?
Oh, well, I never took her out because it was I wasn't that good myself. But just tandeming around, we'd always just average surf, not big surf. Yeah, just Snapper or Wolf Green out, where it was quiet wave, nothing drama.
Mm. Did you have anyone working for you in those early days?
Oh, yeah, I had nearly everyone. What happened is a lot of the guys from the Sydney factories, because I started off in the Sydney factories as I first mentioned when Billy Clymer came up from Torquay in 1957, I started working with him, with the Balsa. And as the time went by, other blokes working for Barry Bennett or Gordon Woods, they'd come up and I'd give them a job at my place. And I had a hell of a lot of guys come through. Gordon Merchant, Mr. Billabong, he worked for me. And actually, in the early days, down in Torquay, I had the two Rip Curl boys were my... they were the... what do you call them?
Apprentices?
Or? No, the... God, there's a senior moment. they looked at, they ordered boards off me. I sent them down to them. People would order boards, a Joe Larkin board. Agents. They were my agents in Victoria. Oh, and they went there before there was Rip Curl.
Did you sell to any other agents anywhere?
Oh, yeah, all over the place. I had shop, you know, I used to do a delivery all the way down to Sydney.
So how many boards were you making a week?
Oh, up to 30, something like that.
So would you say it was a good business?
Well, it would have been a good business if there'd been a good manager. The manager was hopeless, so it wasn't a good business. But it was a fun thing. It was fun. We got by. We got by. No one starved to death.
Did you still find time to surf?
Oh, yeah. That's why he wasn't a good businessman.
When were you going surfing?
Whenever the surf was on. So we'd just shut the shop up and everyone would go surfing. gone surfing on the door. you know, Byron Bay might be on, so we'd just close her up and might stay down there. We used to just sleep on the beach, you know. It was like that. You know, it was that type of business. It was pretty ordinary.
Did you have anything to do with Bob McTavish?
Oh, not really. Bob asked me for a job at one stage about 1962, 1963. But I had really top, the best guys in the business working for me already. So he was only a kid, and I knocked him back. Yeah.
And shape of boards evolved and changed, did you change your boards?
Yeah. What was happening is that I was fairly old, considering
you were born before the war.
Yeah. And the kids, you know, once they got the surfboards, they were trying things from the word go, and they were just developing that quick. They went by us. You know, we might have been the gurus when it started, but within a couple of years, we were old fossils, you know. So I let them have their head, and I think that's how I kept my business going, because any young bloke that came along that wanted to try something and wanted a job, I gave him a job. I gave Michael Peterson the job, and all the young guys that were keen and all that, they virtually had a chance to learn and try their ideas out at my place.
How did you find Michael Peterson working for you? Because he's been described as complex personality, which might in...
It was when he was with me, there's probably about five different Michael Petersons, but when he worked for me, he was very quiet. He knew what he wanted to do and did it. And I had no problems with Michael. I thought he was very shy. That's how he came across to me, as very shy. And as a surfer, he was unbelievable, you know. But that's my take on Michael. Was very extremely shy.
Mm. And tell me a bit about your role as manager of the Queensland team going to the World Championships in 1964.
Well, this was also an accident. The position, we were having a meeting, and we had to form a team or have the Queensland titles, get the winners, and they asked, it was Mandy, we've got to have a manager. And anyhow, Mel Sutherland was picked as the manager, but at the time I think Mel was either just married or we just didn't have the money, he couldn't go, and I didn't have the money either. But I thought, well, it's promoting surfboards and all that. I'll meet a few other people and that, maybe get a few orders or something. So I put my hand up, and I was the second choice as the manager, virtually the only one that had the money to go down there, because we had to pay our own airfares and everything. Anyone that went down there, there was no money. It all had to be paid, you know.
There was sponsorship from one of the petrol companies.
Yeah, there was the contestants, you know, the Queensland champion, senior, junior, and ladies. They were sponsored, but all the rest of the garbage, you know, we had to pay our own way, everything. But it was held at Manly anyhow, and that was my hometown. I'd only been away 4 years. My parents still lived there, and so there was no worry about my accommodation and all that. So, my wife then, she was pregnant, and we both flew down there, and we had a great time.
How long were you down there for?
About a week. Yeah, it was great. It was unbelievable, the amount of people, huge crowds, and the publicity, it was amazing. The people couldn't believe it, you know, because surfing wasn't considered a very nice sport by the general public until
even in the 60s.
Even then, yeah, it was considered a bit of a dropout sport, not a, you know, nothing like being a rugby player or anything like that. But after that, it changed a lot of people's ideas.
Do you think it legitimised the sport?
Well,
to a
obviously,
certain extent?
Yeah, because there seemed to be a rebellion, a young people rebelling against society. That's the way it was looked at.
So linked in with that.
Yeah.
And who organised the sponsorship from the petrol company?
Once again, the beautiful Bob Evans. Without him, that wouldn't have been there. That would have, the Americans would have had the first world titles, no risk. But Bob was a great organiser, and he had a vision. Bob had a vision. A lot of people said he was only looking after himself. I'm sure he was too. He was looking for a way of earning a living out of the sport, the same as the board makers. But, everything was hard. There wasn't that much money. So, everyone was sort of like stealing from Peter to pay Paul. And that's how the whole thing operated. So his heart was definitely with the sport and not his pocket. He was trying to make a living, that's simple as that. And he's the godfather of surfing in Australia.
Mm.
Absolutely.
And when Phyllis O'Donnell entered the competition, was she riding one of your boards?
No, she had been riding my boards. Anyhow, after she won the Queensland titles, Gordon Woods approached her and offered her a sponsorship, and it was better than I could handle. So I said, go ahead, and she informed me that Gordon, I said, well, I can't match that. I said, you go for him. Anyhow, when we got down there, she got the board from Gordon and she didn't like it. Well, she wasn't used to it. And the surf down there is different to the surf up here, but she actually rode my board when she won the title. So I can say that she rode a Joe Larkin when they won the first world titles.
And when you came back from the world titles, prior to that, in order to get a representative to the world titles, you had to form the what is the equivalent now of Surfing Queensland.
Yeah.
So how did you do that? Who did you work with to form that?
Well, once again, it was Bob came up and
Bob Evans.
Yeah, and also he knew Billy Stafford, and there was Johnny Charlton at Kira Beach and Doug Routon at Greenmount. And all those.
Was he a surfer?
No, he wasn't. No. But they were business people, and they were visionary enough to realise this was a good thing, and they got behind it, and we just formed a committee of enthusiasts. I think Mal Sutherland was in it. There was myself, Johnny Charlton, as I said, Bill Stafford. There were the publican's son, who became the first president of the Kira Surf Club, Kira Board Riders. There was, Johnny Dean. There was older blokes.
Was Peter Druin involved at all?
No, he was only about 10 then.
Oh,
because I think Peter was a junior in '66. Still a junior, so Peter would have been probably 14 or something when the titles were on. He was a good surfer, but he was still only a kid. I made him his first surfboard.
Did you?
And his brother, him and Tony. His dad came down with them, so, when they were very young. But, I've had Peter worked in my shop, tried to make his own surfboards. Who else? The Rabbit. Rabbit Bartholomew went through the factory. Peter Townend, the first world champion, in the professional.
What about Nat Young?
I know Nat. I've known him since he was a kid, but we never saw eye to eye. But he was a great surfer, and he still is. He's still a good surfer.
And quite an ambassador for the sport too.
Yeah, well, he got the publicity. He was there was a couple of brothers, the Witzig brothers, and
So John and Paul.
John and Witzig. Paul. John just had a thing, and they sort of like they had a fair bit of control because of their the magazine and the films, air tracks, and if they promoted someone, well. You got to the top of the list, you know. Whereas, and Peter Drillen was right, the publicity was mainly Sydney. So Peter, in 1966, won the junior Australian title. He would have eaten all the seniors as well if they'd let him surf. He was much, much better. And no one knew him. He never got any publicity, nothing, and... He keeps on bringing it up. He said that we never got any publicity. It's right.
They without didn't. The publicity, you don't get the sponsorship either.
No.
You don't get your name out there.
No.
And tell me about judging. You've been a judge too, and that's changed a fair bit over time, hasn't it?
The judging at the first world titles, we didn't. No one knew how to judge. No one had done it before.
Were you one of the judges?
Yes, I was at the final. And there was a bit of controversy about that, but we had had a meeting, and Phil Edwards, who was the American surfer, who was considered one of the greatest surfers in the world at the time, he suggested a few things, and we brought up a code of sportsmanship, which if they, you know, they weren't allowed to drop in or all this sort of thing, and when that came, you know, when that was calculated into it, Midget won, you know, because the other American was stealing waves and all that sort of thing, which they were all told. There were six guys in the finals and six world champions, in my opinion. That's the way I look at it, and... there's always got to be one, two, three, and four, you know, and that was the way it dropped. But we didn't know what we were doing. But there's arguments today at the world titles. You know, blokes that go along, they say, well, they can't figure out how so-and-so beat so-and-so, and that happens at every contest. So it's it's very personal. I like a style of surfing and... You don't, so, and you're judging. So I'm going to judge for the bloke style I like. You're going to, so who's the best surfer? There's 10,000 world champions around today.
And was it commonplace to have someone coming up after the competition to have a conversation with you because they didn't agree with you?
Not in the early days, because really very few people cared. Yeah, it was a fun sport, and there was the odd individual obviously that did, but well, I never saw much of it, and even if I did, I'd just tell them to go jump.
And how do you think the culture changed in the 70s when there really was a surfing culture of unemployed people, because the dole was actually pretty easy to get back then, and people were living for the men were living for the sport. Yeah.
Well, I didn't see much of that, to be perfectly honest. There were guys that wouldn't work, but a lot of the surfers were willing to work when it suited them. You know, if there was no surf, yeah, they were great workers. You know, some of the Sydney guys were coming up, they'd get jobs in restaurants, you know, and work at night and all that, and they're probably still getting the dole too. But
and what about the introduction of drugs, not just to surfing? It became quite common in lots of areas of society.
Well, that became, because of the, mainly, I think, the Vietnam War with the R&R, the American soldiers coming over with the grass and other stuff. And, the problem with surfing is that when there's no surf, it becomes very boring. And, you know, they, some guys took the drugs on and handled it, and others just got blown away with it, you know, like Paul Michael, you know. A lot of the guys were into it, maybe not as much as him, but they played with it and walked away, whereas Michael just got hooked up. And it's so sad, you know, I drink a lot, you know, and I did. And I suppose that's the same sort of thing. It's a drug, but it doesn't have the ramifications of the other. You know, one's legal and one's illegal. That's the difference.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned before that when you had the factory, when the surf was up, you'd just put a sign on the door saying, gone surfing.
Yep.
So what was more important to you, surfing or shaping?
The surfing. Yeah, I'd rather be doing it than shaping, regardless of how much you like it. It's still a job. Whereas surfing is just 100% pleasure, you know. So.
And what did surfing mean for you? Some people talk about it as a spiritual experience. Was it for you?
I'm not into the arty part of it, you know. The main thing, I got a lot of fun, enjoyment, complete and utter enjoyment. You'd be laughing your head off. And that's I thought that was a good enough result. So that's what I loved about it. It was so much fun, you know. And, you know, you're with a group of like-minded people, and it was, you know, it was the fun in the water, out of the water, partying. It was all, you know, on the same wavelength, you know.
So there was a real community, surfing community.
Oh, yeah. And like the surf club, the same thing. All the people that I know, you know, from the surf club, I might have only met them once or twice in the water. But then you'd go, you know, 2 years would go by and you'd run into them again and you're like old mates. And we only spoken for about half an hour in our lives. But the whole surfing movement was like that. You know, all the Torquay guys, the Manly guys, the guys from Scarborough in Western Australia, you all became mates just after, you know, 10 minutes because you all thought the same. They seemed to be larrikins the same, you know. It was marvellous. And the board riding's the same. I don't know about for young people. I'm only talking from my perspective, but most of the guys that I know, yeah, that's all it was fun. Mm. And fun while you're making a living as well.
So you had the factory from 1957 to 1978. You were a full-time board maker and you closed the factory for the first time in 1978.
Mm.
In that time, did you bring the major changes like leg ropes and three fins? And
no, well, we were into... we were doing the three finners in the end, but that wasn't none of them were my innovations. The kids that worked for me, they made the boards a little bit shorter, and that's why I had them working for me, because it had gone by me. It was another era completely, you know, like we were from the 16-foot era, and when it got 10, that was a big step down for us. So when the kids started coming down to 8 foot and 7 foot, I couldn't ride them.
Mm.
So I left it up to them. So the innovators were the people that worked for me.
And are there any names that stand out?
Oh, well, Michael Peterson with his big long fin on the, you know, Peter Townend had his own ideas. Rabbit had his own ideas. Peter Druin. They all experimented.
And in those days, I noticed when you showed me one of the boards. Oh, no, actually, it was Mal Sutherland showed me one of your boards. It just had your name on it. Did you ever introduce graphics or design work to your boards?
I used to do what we used to do, colours and that, you know, like stripes and stringers and wood stringers and all that. the artwork came from the artist type blokes, you know, that were at surfers. So they had Jimmy Davison out here. He was a great artist, you know, and there's a lot of great artists, you know, and the surfers. And they put into the boards what was in their head, you know, and that's how the...
But your boards, they did this with your boards?
Yeah, well, only if someone would come and say, oh, I want so-and-so to put this on the board, well, I'd take it over to Jimmy Davison and he'd do his artwork on it and then we'd come back and glass it.
Otherwise, they just said Joe Larkin on them,
didn't they? Yeah,
And did you ever have any articles written about you in tracks, that appeared in tracks?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, we've been in books and all that sort of thing.
Yeah, but in tracks, did you have to seek those articles in earlier times? Or
we paid for the ads, but quite often if they did an article on you, you bought an ad. So it went hand in hand. It was a promotion, you know. So if you want an article, you nearly had to buy an ad. Mm. Very, very rare that... sometimes I got articles without doing ads, but mainly you had to be in the magazines.
Mm. And when did you give up... was it photography and filmmaking you were involved
when in? When I first moved up here, 1963, I think. It might have been even 1962. Bob came up and I said, look, I'm not interested anymore. I'm too interested in this, trying to get the boards going. How about you buy the gear off me? You know, because I'd paid for most of the cameras and that. So we struck a deal and that was it. It was all over as far as I was concerned, you know. Once I left Sydney, it was over virtually. Because Sydney was the heart of it. And you know, it's a lot of time involved to get to all these places with your camera and set them up and all that. It's,
And why did you start the factory up again 20 years after you'd closed it?
Oh, well, the factory is that shed over there now that you've been over to.
Oh, I see, I never...
No, that's it. And it was mainly because I had... All the old boards were in the house in Harbord from the plywood day. And my niece, who'd bought the family home, wanted to renovate the garage. And they said, all these old boards are up here, Uncle Joe. So I said, oh, well, I was going to put them in the tip. But luckily enough, the freshy boat crew were coming up for the titles. And my mate down in Sydney said, I'll see Noxie and we'll put them in the boat for you and drop them off when they get up here to Cabarita Beach. And I said, oh, that's great. So that, and then when I had all the bits there, I thought, I was retiring, and I thought, I might make one of these for the kids, just for their wall, you know. And I started on one, wondering whether I could still do it. And halfway through it, a bloke came in and said, I'll buy it. And then I finished it, and someone saw it, and they said, oh, can you make me one? And on it went.
Mm.
And... So it's kept me busy for my retirement.
So how many would you make now?
Oh, not that many. Probably in a year I might make half a dozen, something like that.
So. And what do they sell for these days?
Oh, enough.
Enough.
Yeah.
And your earlier boards, are they collector's items now?
I think any of the early boards are collectible, you know, if they're in good nick. And even if they're not... A lot of people ask me, you know, what they should do. Should they do them right up? And I say, no, leave them like they are. They're 50-year-old. You know, they've got to have a few dings and wax. And, yeah, just clean them up, but don't overdo it. Don't paint them up. I don't like them being re... That's my take on it. But a lot of people go to a lot of trouble and they get them to look very beautiful, but it's not an old board anymore.
No, it's not. Well, just before we close the interview, is there anything I haven't asked you that you'd like to talk about?
Oh, you remember you were asking about trips and all that, but when we first came up here, Noosa was an unknown quantity. And we used to do trips up to Noosa every now and then. And then Hayden Kenny started making surfboards up in the North Coast. And then I lost a few of my workers to Hayden. But we also did trips up to Agnes Waters, you know. Like, a lot of people don't realise how hard it was to get into Agnes Waters in those days. I got my car stuck in a creek, getting across the creek, and I had to get the old farmer out with the tractor to get out of this creek, you know.
What sort of car did you have, or did you have a combi?
No, I had a big flash American tank. That's how it got stuck. I had a big Rambler, Rebel. They were a big American car, big station wagon. It was an enormous thing. And when I've gone down the creek, the bumper bar and the front and the back got hooked up. It wasn't like that. It was, you know, but it was such a big car that it managed to get itself hooked up. But they were great trips, and, you know, we had a lot of fun there, Agnes Waters. Now it's like 1770, it's the place to go, you know.
Yeah, I know. It's still a long nothing. Way. It's still a fair way out, though, isn't it?
Oh, you go into Bundy now, and there's a coast road runs straight up the back, and you're there in no time. What used to take us 6 hours takes an hour and a half now. Mm.
And where were some of the other spots that you liked to go?
Oh, well, we used to go into Seal Rocks was a great trip. You know, that was a great place. And Crescent Heads was marvellous. They had the country club there, you know, right on the beach, and we used to camp. They had a camping area, but no one worried about collecting money, so it was all cheap and good fun, you know. And
a bit different these days, isn't it?
Coffs Harbour, around Coffs Harbour, no one was surfing, really. I introduced surfing to nearly Coffs Harbour. So it was, all the whole coast was marvellous, it was all good fun.
And when was the last time you surfed?
About nearly 10 years ago, 12 years ago, yeah.
And was that here at Cabarita?
Yeah, Cabarita.
Do you consider this to be a good surfing beach?
Yeah, it's always seems to have a little bit of something going for it, you know, like, and you've got the south side if the northerly's blowing for not the world's greatest wave, but not bad. I think it rates something like 30 in Australia, so it's not too bad.
Mm.
And, you know, it's there, it's handy without travelling, isn't it?
Yeah. And have any of your children or grandchildren taken up the sport?
A little granddaughter in America, she's learning it, but I don't know whether, you know. Both my daughters had played with it but never took it up, as you'd say. So I think the same might happen there, but I don't know about the little bloke yet, the little boy. He's only 6. He's a little bit scared of the water, like all the are some of them, but sometimes if they are scared, it's better. They come, you know, they get more confident later.
Yeah. Well, it's obviously been wonderful for you.
Oh, I loved it. Mm. Yeah, it would change nothing. Change absolutely nothing. And you don't need money, do you? You only need nice cold beer and a bit of a feed, and you're right, somewhere to sleep.
That's too true. Okay, I'd like to thank you very much for your time
this
morning.
Yeah, thank you.